Well, tonight, Wisconsin sending a message to President Joe Biden that could very well spell trouble come November. As for Donald Trump, well, he's got a message of his own. Plus, the breaking news out of Taiwan. Have you seen the images already? A massive earthquake rattles the island, the strongest quake in nearly quarter a century. Yeah. A live update in just moments tonight on Laura Coates Live. All right, by now, we've all heard about the undecideds, right? But President Biden is facing what may be his most worrying opponent so far in the battleground state of Wisconsin, the uncommitted. They're counting those primary votes as we speak. And now we've got another vocab term to consider, the uninstructed. So far, there are more than 37,000 votes for uninstructed. And even though Biden won easily, 37,000 votes is nothing in a race as tight as this. Is that another warning to the president on his handling of Israel's war in Gaza and the risk it poses for his chances at re-election? President Biden even writing a statement that this evening that Israel has, quote, not done enough to protect civilians, and saying he is outraged and heartbroken over the deaths of aid workers from World Central Kitchen in Israeli strike in Gaza. The president changing plans to host a dinner tonight to break the Ramadan fast after pushback from guests who said it would be inappropriate while people are starving in Gaza. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is hammering Joe Biden on immigration using incendiary language like, quote, border bloodbath, and threatening if he doesn't win, this could be the last election in America.
I'm here tonight to declare that Joe Biden's border bloodbath, remember they used the name bloodbath, I was talking about something entirely different, but this is a border bloodbath, ends the day I take the oath of office. If we don't win, this may be the last election our country ever has, and there could be truth to it. That's where we're going, because Joe Biden is a threat to democracy. He's the threat to democracy.
Trump also dangling a promised statement next week on Florida's six-week abortion ban, which will be on the ballot again in the fall when voters decide on a state constitutional amendment that would protect the right to an abortion in Florida. Now, it's frankly more than fair to wonder why exactly it's going to take him a week to come up with a statement when he's been crowing about the demise of Roe v. Wade for almost 2 years. I mean, he's been taking credit for overturning it every chance he gets. Well, he's saying credit. Democrats are saying that he is responsible. That's a point Democrats aren't letting anyone forget, directly blaming Trump for bans like the one in Florida that President Biden says, quote, are putting the health and lives of millions of women at risk. I want to bring in Megan Hayes, former special assistant to President Biden, and former Republican Congressman Joe Walsh is also here. Welcome to you both. What a night. I mean, it's hard to imagine we are still in the so-called primary season, knowing we have these two candidates at this point. But the third party candidate really seems to be uncommitted or uninstructed. Megan, to you first. This is a real problem for Biden, and the humanitarian crisis also getting worse. There was a strike on the aid workers just yesterday, and he is getting protested at every event that he has. So how does Biden course correct, if at all?
Look, I think that he definitely needs to take into account what these folks are saying. It's a huge problem for him. This entire conflict is fraught with problems for the administration. There's no question that there needs to be more humanitarian aid done in Gaza. I know being with him when we were in Poland and working with World Central Kitchen, this is personal to him. He is friends with Jose Andres. We saw the work they were doing firsthand when we were there. It's extremely devastating to have this attack happen. And then for Bibi to not, or for Netanyahu not to take responsibility in a real way or have any sort of remorse or feeling towards this is devastating for the administration.
What did you make of Biden's response and reaction to Netanyahu talking about how he's outraged and heartbroken and that they have not done enough to protect civilians?
I think to what Megan said, Laura, look, this is a bad issue for him. Why? Because he's pro-Israel. But this divides his base. The left is not pro-Israel. Most moderate Democrats are. So it divides his very voting coalition. And Laura, when he tries to play it cautiously down the middle on this issue, he pleases no one. What he needs to do is stand in front of his base and say, I'm pro-Israel. I'm going to listen to your concerns. But Laura, he's going to have to confront his left flank on this issue.
Is saying he's pro-Israel going to solve the problem on his base?
I don't think so. I don't think it. I don't think that you. I think the uncommitted is a huge issue, and I think that you need those people to turn out, and you need these people to turn out in these battleground states. Like, Michigan has a huge Arab population. Like, you can't isolate all of these folks. I do think it solves some of the issue, but I don't think it solves the problem completely.
I mean, one of the questions people have is, are you uncommitted now, but ultimately going to vote for Biden later on? That's the key, turnout, right? Because many people who are uncommitted now aren't going to go for Trump.
Most will. And Trump's got this problem.
Most will what? Turn
most
out?
Most will turn got out it. Eventually and vote. For, just like, I think most Nikki Haley voters are going to support Trump at the end of the day. Look, this is an angry electorate. We are living in an angry populist moment. Trump's an evil demagogue. Why are people even thinking about RFK Jr.? Because they're looking for something different. Trump feeds this he inflames this anger with bad stuff. But Joe Biden doesn't recognize, Laura, how angry the populace is. He's got to get his arms around that.
Well, if the population is that angry, does the inflammatory rhetoric of Trump as relates to, say, the border, is that feeding the beast?
So I do think he recognizes how angry they are. I just am not sure that his tenor and demeanor and his words are is helping the cause, right? Like, there people are listening to Trump and people are getting excited and by the incendiary language. And that's just not Joe Biden's style. That's not how he's going to run. He runs a much different, he has more empathy and more compassion for folks. And that comes across when he's campaigning. So I think that it is a challenge for him to connect with folks that are more fired up and more, you know, more incendiary.
But does the rhetoric make people have a visceral reaction such that they will be more inclined to turn out?
Oh, yes. And weirdly, again, everything Trump spouts is cruel and just bigoted BS. And he did it again today, Laura. But it doesn't hurt him. Even a lot of black voters and brown voters are concerned about crime and the border. And even though Trump lies about it, he feeds into it. I agree with Megan. Biden's Biden. But Biden needs to address these issues head on.
I mean, Trump is talking about a woman by the name of Ruby Garcia, who was tragically killed also by an illegal immigrant. Listen to what he had to say on this issue.
11 days ago, right here in Kent County, a 25-year-old Michigan woman named Ruby Garcia, who's become a very well-known name, beautiful young woman, was savagely murdered by an illegal alien criminal. Now Ruby's loved ones and community are left grieving for this incredible young woman. I spoke to some of her family.
Well, on that point, tonight, Ruby Garcia's family or her sister said that no one from her family ever spoke to Trump. So you're not surprised by that.
Oh, God, no, not at all. I mean, his entire purpose, Laura, is to scare the hell out of voters, and he'll lie to do it.
When you look at this issue, and there's been so many people from State of the Union and on, where people have looked and been very critical about the use of people and their tragedy for political gain. And there has been fierce critique from both sides against both parties, frankly. Yeah. Is there a way to address and confront, especially on the issues of crime and the intersection of immigration policy, without alienating both sides?
I would hope so. I mean, that's what democracy is supposed to be built on. But I just am not seeing it with this election. I think, look, the border, they had a border bill that was bipartisan in the Senate, and Trump put a stop to it with his Republicans on the House side. So it's you kind of wonder, you sit back and wonder, like, how are you now blaming President Biden for this when you're the one who and your supporters are the ones that didn't want to pass this through when they had a bipartisan bill in the Senate? And it's just, you just kind of sit back and think to yourself, like, people who are traveling thousands of miles to cross the border for a hope of a better life, like, we have a real problem here that we need to address. But not all people, not all immigrants are animals, like he called them today. Like, that's an incendiary statement that's just so divisive and so hateful that it's kind of hard to understand what's happening.
And I want to hear Joe Biden say that. I want to hear Joe Biden say that in front of real live people instead of ignoring the issue.
Well, here's what he is saying tonight, an issue where, frankly, there are people traveling thousands of miles, but it's not for migratory purposes. It's because of abortion laws in this country in particular. Here he is confronting what Democrats believe to be a winning issue for them.
Because for 54 years, they were trying to get Roe v. Wade terminated, and I did it, and I'm proud to have done it.
In 2016, Donald Trump ran to overturn Roe v. Wade. Now, in 2024, he's running to pass a national ban on a woman's right to choose. I'm running to make Roe v. Wade the law of the land again.
So they think that maybe Florida might be into play now because of this 6-week abortion ban, and it'll be on the ballot in November. Is it wishful thinking?
No, it could be. Look, this is the best issue the Democrats have. And Laura, my fellow Republicans know this is their Achilles heel.
What do you think?
I 100% agree with you. I think it's shown in the midterms and in, you know, there's a bunch of states just in Alabama recently where the state delegate person won right after the IVF ruling. There's just, this is a losing issue for Republicans. And it's also a very important issue for not only women, but men as well. And it polls really well. So I'm not understanding why the Republicans are not understanding that this is not a winning issue for them.
Or why it will take a week for Trump to have a position on this. I mean, and I just have to say, when you think about the amount of time, I mean, for so long, in the conversations about reproductive rights and about abortion, the week by week has been the crucial issue. And so if a week doesn't matter, if a week is nothing politically, then why is it so strict in terms of the reduction of rights? Megan Hayes, Joe Walsh, thank you both so much. And if you thought Donald Trump was staying on script tonight and focusing on the issues, well, listen to him comparing his legal troubles to those of one, wait for it, Al Capone.
I got indicted more than Alphonse Capone. Al Capone. Scarface. You know how bad he was? You know, I know some of the guys in the front row. They're tough guys. If you ever looked at Alphonse Capone, you wouldn't be tough at all. You'd be dead by the morning, most likely. I got indicted more than Alphonse. Alphonse was a tough man. They did a movie called Scarface. Check it out. Even if it was half true, you don't want to deal with him.
I've never heard him called Alphonse. I don't know. Just saying that. Anyway, joining me now, Norm Eisen. He's a CNN legal analyst and the author of Trying Trump and a former White House ethics czar. Norm, I'm so glad that you're here today. I'm all for a movie reference. I happen to love the movie Scarface. Whatever Al Pacino does, frankly, I do love. He makes a lot of comparisons for himself. And one of the things he continues to believe is that he is entirely persecuted. And he blames judges. And whether he's saying hello to his little friend, the one he has now is recusal. Talk to me about the issue of recusal here. Because the goal in trying to attack the judge's daughter, to me, is all about him trying to get out of having that judge preside over the case.
It's a little strange for a law and order candidate to embrace the memory of Al Capone. But it's even stranger, Laura, to go back to the court when Judge Mershon has already ruled that the activities of his adult daughter do not provide a basis for a recusal. He even went to the New York Judicial Ethics Authorities, and he got a formal opinion. And they said, if your daughter is not a party in the case, if her business is not a party in the case, if she's not a witness in the case, adult kids are allowed to have lives. So why is Donald Trump, having lost this, raising it again? Pure politics. It is a losing legal issue.
Now, many would look at, I want to lean into your ethics chops here, which are extensive. Some would look at this issue and say, well, hold on a second. If the fact that there's an adult daughter says it can be totally compartmentalized from the father, the judge, why is the same not true for, say, a Clarence Thomas and his wife?
Well, my ethics experience is as being the ethics czar for Barack Obama. And I can tell you that never once in his 8 years in office did he compare himself to Al Capone. That's kind of an ethics benchmark.
Now, one would think that's a pretty low bar.
But look at the difference between the Clarence Thomas situation, where his wife, Ginny, was a witness who testified to the January 6th committee. She was involved in the events. She spoke to some of those who are being prosecuted, including Mark Meadows in Fulton County, for their involvement in the events that culminated in January 6th. That falls within this boundary that the New York ethics authorities pointed to. If a judge has a relative who's a witness, Lauren Mershon is not a witness in the case. So I don't think we're going to see Donald Trump say that Clarence Thomas must recuse from the immunity case that is about whether Donald Trump is immune from prosecution. Mm-hmm. So there is an element of hypocrisy here, and using the court to write campaign press releases, that does not make judges happy.
One of the things that Mershon spoke about was that the motion contains a daisy chain of innuendo. I've made a daisy chain. They were actually like dandelions, but that's neither here nor there. When you look at the idea, there's no facts. It's just the political hyperbole. He's obviously hoping that this is heard by those who might receive the information, i.e. a jury.
There is an element of seeking to taint the jury pool, and that's what he's struggling against. That's part of what gag orders are about. The judge talked very explicitly in his ruling yesterday about the intimidating effect that Trump's behavior can have on juries. But I think the primary strategy there is Trump wants a hung jury. There's very powerful evidence in this case. I write about that in Trying Trump. We looked at the data on almost 10,000 of these falsifying business records cases. Hundreds of them, felony ones, resulted in incarceration. That makes Trump nervous. What's his solution? He wants one juror, one pro-Trump juror who will hang that jury. So he is playing to that. And of course, his political audience feeding their grievances with this constant drumbeat, finding something to complain about with the judge.
And even more, he doesn't want this trial to go forward on April 15th, the jury selection. He would like this judge to not oversee this case. But just really quick, what is the standard that has to take place for a judge to recuse themselves? When does it become mandatory?
Well, when a judge has an actual disqualifying conflict or an appearance of a conflict, if his daughter were a witness in the case, if he had a financial interest in the case, those kinds of things constitute a conflict. We are not remotely close to that here. And this judge is not going to disqualify himself, and nobody else is going to disqualify him. It's a PR move by Trump.
Well, we will see what happens. Norm Eisen, always great to hear from you. The book coming out, too, Trying Trump, will be a really, really interesting and timely read. Also, a major earthquake rocking Taiwan tonight. It's the worst in 25 years. I mean, look at this. There was a live news broadcast interrupted. The camera was shaking. Debris was falling from the ceiling. And buildings like this are on the verge of collapse. We've got a live report for you next.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
We have breaking news. A major 7.4 magnitude earthquake striking near the east coast of Taiwan. You can see just some of the damage there. A building left completely tilted. The shaking so bad, debris began falling from the ceiling during this TV broadcast. I want to bring in CNN's Hanako Montgomery in Tokyo. Hanako, what can you tell us?
Yeah, Laura, I mean, a really large and alarming earthquake like you saw in that video there to have shaken Taiwan. Now, what we know about this earthquake is that its epicenter was very close to Hualin County in eastern Taiwan. This is a very popular tourist destination. It is a rural part of Taiwan and actually where most of these earthquakes take place in Taiwan. Now, we also know that this is the biggest earthquake in 25 years. The last one was back in 1999 when an earthquake of a magnitude of 7.7 killed more than 2,400 people in Taiwan. Now, for this specific earthquake that took place this morning, we haven't heard any official reports about deaths so far, but the Taiwanese government is reporting about injuries, some people stuck in these homes and buildings. In fact, 26 buildings have been destroyed and collapsed. We're also hearing about roads being partially destroyed and more than 91,000 households without power. Now, in response to this natural disaster, the Taiwanese Defense Ministry has dispatched military troops to assist with evacuation efforts. Now, this is very common protocol. You see military troops work with local governments to try to get people to safety, to higher ground. Now, we also know that in Hualin County, all schools and work have been suspended for today because of these constant aftershocks that we've been seeing. And the Taiwanese government has warned that this could continue for the next 3 to 4 days. And let me tell you, Laura, as someone who lives in a very seismically active country, Japan, these aftershocks can be just as terrifying as that initial earthquake because you never know when the shaking is going to stop, Laura.
Hanako Montgomery, thank you for bringing us the very latest. Please keep us updated. Now I want to turn to a small town in Oklahoma. Tonight, sending, frankly, a very big message. Voters in Enid giving the boot to a council member with white supremacist ties. His name is Judd Blevins, and he was elected to the city council last year by just 36 votes. And then his past began to get more and more attention. Now, you can see him here. If that scene looks familiar, it's probably because you've seen it before. That's the 2017 Unite the Right rally, where neo-Nazis and white nationalists marched through the streets of Charlottesville, Virginia. Judd says he was protesting the removal of Confederate statues. But it doesn't end there. A monitoring group called Right Wing Watch later reported he was a recruiter for a white nationalist group. It says that he posted offensive messages like these in an online discussion group. Now, once all that began to spread more widely, it led to a push to then recall him from the council. And now he's out, losing to Cheryl Patterson in that recall. As for what Judd says about the accusations, well, it's a bit maybe wishy-washy is the way to describe it at best. He's apologized at times, denying he's a white nationalist, but he's also been defiant and has held his ground on being able to speak freely. He was on the brink of being censored last fall, but that censure was postponed after the only black commissioner on the city council forgave him.
I want to do one thing before we quit. Can you stand up? Do you love me?
Yes, I do, as a brother in Christ.
I love you too. I forgive you.
Thank you.
That commissioner, Derwin Norwood, he joins me now. Derwin, thank you so much for joining me. How are you this evening?
I'm doing great. Laura, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad you're here. Well, thank you. And I'm glad that you are here. I want to get to that moment of forgiveness that, frankly, I have been replaying in my mind even after seeing it. But first, I do want to ask you about these results. Judd Blevins has been recalled officially. What is your reaction?
Well, it's a blessing to see him relieved. I've gotten to know him a little bit more personally than anyone else on the council. And in confidence, he shared things with me. And I'm aware of the fact that it's bigger than Judd Blevins. It's a national problem that we have had for a long time. And there are citizens in Enid that were brave enough to take it upon themselves to fight back against white supremacy. I felt sorry for Judd, you know, and the conversations that he's had with me privately, I really know how he feels about certain situations and things that have happened that he's not going to share with everyone else.
So why, over the course of those conversations, and I'm intrigued by the trusting rapport that you have built, but what about those conversations has made you feel sorry for him?
Just the fact that he got caught up. You know, he went to the military, came back to the United States, and during the Trump era, I'm just going to tell the truth tonight. He heard things that inspired him and made him feel that his race was in trouble and he needed to defend and, you know, his heritage more than anything else. He felt the need to defend his heritage.
When you hear that, especially given his military service, you can imagine there are many members of the military who would hear that and think that's anathema to the protection of the values we hold so dear, in spite of the history of, we know, the experience of many Black soldiers returning from World War II and beyond. But let me ask you, were you surprised to hear that his military experience was a catalyst?
Yes, absolutely. I was. But, you know, I've had many uncles, my father, he served in the military himself. So I've never been in the military. You know, there's things that happen in the military, just like they do in the civilian world, that we don't know anything about. And those experiences can change your perception, you know, and they can have effects on you short term and long term throughout your life.
Is that what's motivated you to forgive him?
Well, what actually motivated me to forgive him was my upbringing in the Pentecostal Holiness Church, which is the Church of God in Christ. I was trained that all souls belong to God. You know, I read it in God's word. And being a man of God myself, I felt like if I can speak about it or preach on it, I need to live it. So I wanted to be an example for the former commissioner. I wanted to be his example. When I read the life of Apostle Paul, there was a great change that took place. And I believe that God can change anyone if they want to be changed.
Well, I know Kojic very well. Many of my family members in Florida are members of a Church of God in Christ. And I have to ask you, when I'm looking at that moment, the pace of that conversation had me wondering at first, were either of you aware, did he know that you were going to ask him that question about his love for you at that time?
He did not, neither did I.
Really?
When the Spirit of God is moving, you don't have any control. You know, and when those convictions come about, you just have to react. And, you know, being prayerful and believing and fasting, the power of the Holy Ghost, you don't know which way he's going to move you. But when it happens, it happens. So, you know, I wanted God to get the glory in all of this.
Let me ask you, when you look at this, and I have to wonder, given the nature of your relationship that you have explained, you seem to have gotten either closer with him or understood him in a different way. Do you think his ousting from this council is going to trigger him to revert to the beliefs he once had or might still have?
Hopefully not, because the way I look at it, Laura, is the fact that he's an individual. He has a soul. I don't care about his ethnicity, his race, or anything. What I care about is his soul. I want to see true change. And if I can be that individual that can help him along the way, I'm not taking it personal. I feel like I have a mission to do. And that's to help convert individuals who have been deceived.
Have you spoken to him tonight since he was ousted?
No, ma'am. I spoke to him last Friday. And I explained to him that, you know, I have talked to CNN, and I did an interview with him at my father's church, Westside Church of God in Christ. And he thanked me and he said, "Derwin, I respect you." And I told him, I said, "Judd, When I watched you up on that stage, I felt sorry for you. You were struggling. You were really going through. And when I seen his mother, and she came up to me and she introduced herself to me, it hit me because I could see the pain in her eyes. And he told me, he said, "You're absolutely right. This is really hurting my mother." They're humans. We all make mistakes.
What did you understand to be hurting her? The admission from her son or the attention that was being provided?
I believe all of the above. I believe that when I looked at her, no mother wants to see her child.
So. No. No, you certainly do not, as any mother would know. Derwin Norwood, thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura, for having me. God bless you.
Thank you. Well, there's a ruling by Florida's Supreme Court. It's now presenting women with a very stark choice, shall we say. Some may have to drive 17 hours to seek abortion-related services. Next, how one clinic all the way in Illinois is trying to help them.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
No woman in America should live in medical apartheid. It should be now clear that Dobbs was more than just about abortion.
The Biden administration tearing into Florida's Supreme Court decision allowing a six-week abortion ban to go into effect on May 1st, a ruling bound to leave women in Florida with very few options. One of those options, travel far and wide for essential health care, a trip that typically comes with a prohibitive price tag for many everyday Americans. I mean, take a look at this map. Driving to Illinois could take anywhere from 11 to 17 hours. You may wonder why I'm even highlighting Illinois. It's nearly 1,000 miles away from Florida. Well, one reproductive care clinic in that Midwestern state is bracing for an uptick in out-of-state patients in the coming weeks. Joining me now with a personal perspective, Executive Administrator of Alamo Women's Clinic of Illinois, Andrea Gallegos. Thank you so much for joining us right now. Andrea, people are thinking, why is Illinois preparing for what's happening in Florida? Why are you, and what are you preparing to do?
Sure. Thanks for having me. So, you know, we've seen since Dobbs, patients from every surrounding banned state make the journey of great distances for care. And because Illinois is this island of access to abortion care, I have no doubt that Floridians will be faced to do the same thing.
I mean, you've been helping women from other states where abortion has been banned or restricted. It must be taking a toll on them personally to travel to this island of access, as you describe it. What are they telling you?
Absolutely. I think more than anything, when patients make it to our doorstep, they're exhausted. They're exhausted from their travel. They've left work and just gotten on the road and started driving. And sleep a few hours before their appointment in the morning. I've had patients tell me they've driven all night and slept in the parking lot and waited for us to open in the morning. So the journeys never cease to amaze me what patients are overcoming to make it to our doorstep. So pure exhaustion, I think, is number one. And then by the end of the day, when after they've had services, it more than anything, it's relief. Relief that they made it, relief that somebody took care of them, that they got the services they needed, and they can return safely home.
There's the emotional and physical toll and aspect of this and the journey, but there's also the financial toll. How are these women able to pay for their health care plus the cost of travel, knowing that increasingly so, there is an economic disparity of access?
Absolutely. These bans disproportionately affect women of color, women who are of lower socioeconomic statuses. And the majority of our patients, I would say 75% to 80% of our patients receive some sort of funding, whether it be from a national fund or state specific to their home state. We connect with multiple organizations to help make cost less burdensome.
Really, truly telling when I think about the map we were showing, the idea of 17 hours drive, an island of access in Illinois, and how other states are preparing to accept the influx of people who most assuredly will come. Andrea Gallegos, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, up next, LSU star Angel Reese calling out the hate she has gotten this past year, from racism to threats against her own life. Has the price of fame in this social media era we're in become way too toxic? Former WNBA star and coach Nancy Lieberman is here to discuss next.
Death threats, I've been sexualized, I've been threatened, I've been so many things, and I've stood strong every single time.
Now remind me what that saying is again: all publicity is good publicity. Well, all the greats have had their careers criticized. Great athletes, great actors, great artists. You want the fame, you got to deal with the heat, right? I don't agree with that, because recently the so-called heat has felt like hate. Criticism has turned into racism. Game commentary has turned into death threats. And often it's anonymous. People are hiding behind their screens on social media. Now, here is what 21-year-old college basketball phenom Angel Reese and her teammates had to say in a post-game presser last night.
I've been through so much. I've seen so much. I've been attacked so many times. Death threats. I've been sexualized. I've been threatened. Just know, like, I'm still a human.
People speak hate into her life. I've never seen people wish bad things on someone as much as her.
The media, y'all, how they like to twist and call it a villain and all of that, y'all don't know Angel, bro. And I'm just happy that I get to play with her.
The hate has become such an epidemic that even the Surgeon General of the United States met with the NCAA Mental Health Advisory Group to talk about the effects of social media on young people's mental health. Lots to talk about with Nancy Lieberman. She's the head coach of Team Power in the Big Three League, the first woman head coach of a men's professional team in any sport, a two-time Olympian, a two-time Basketball Hall of Famer, a player, a coach, otherwise known as Lady Magic, and a Hall of Famer to boot. Nancy, so nice to see you. How you doing?
I am wonderful. So great to see you again.
I'm glad that you're here, although I have got to wonder what you have thought, seeing the evolution of the game in the sense of the role that media and social media is playing on and what's happening. What you've heard what Angel Reese had to say about being a human, the toll it's taken on her. What would you say to her in this moment?
Well, I watched the game and I watched her reaction in the press conference. And as somebody who's in the sisterhood of this sport, of all sports, to see this young lady that despondent at the press conference, not because of how she played, by the way, she has 17 points, 20 rebounds, and she is a wizard and a star, but for how people have treated her, shame on you. You know, Muhammad Ali, my friend, my hero, told me a long time ago that the greatest religion in the world is love and kindness. Show this woman some love and kindness. And, you know, don't go after her because you're a keyboard wizard and you hide. If you got to say something to somebody, stand up, be seen, because all you're going to do is people are going to say you're racist, you're wrong. And, you know, the media has gotten desensitized and how they talk about us as players, as coaches, as women. And it's unacceptable. And honestly, it's bullshit.
I'm so glad you've mentioned Muhammad Ali, because people sometimes will point to him and say, oh, no, the smack talk is part of it. You know, his poetic lyricism when he did it is just the evolution of that. This feels and is distinct from what that was. And I'm so glad you've mentioned how it's being directed at women in particular. Why do you think it's become so increasingly toxic as it relates to women in particular?
I mean, let's be realistic. Every star that you've known in history, I'll take sports, every time they get to the top, somebody is now trying to cut you down and put you in your place. So, you know, Angel Reese gets to a certain place, wins the national championship. She's beautiful. She has an opinion. And now everybody wants to cut her down and attack her. She's never done anything wrong. I mean, she's 21 years old. She should be living life. She should be happy. She's had a great program at LSU. She's got great mentors in Mulkey and Shaq. And if I were around her, you know, I'd put my arm around her as a friend and say, don't listen. Sometimes you just have to, you know, kind of have, you know, earmuffs and not listen to people. Those are the people who have never accomplished anything in life. And so it's so easy for them to be critics of people who have achieved. And, you know, I guess jealousy is real.
You know, I always say I don't take criticism from people I would not seek advice from. But I'm grown compared to a 21-year-old and thinking about what she's enduring as a college student. But this is a different sport in a way. I mean, college players now are able to have endorsements, are able to have brand deals. Does that make a difference to you at all in terms of the increasingly expansive public profile that they have for themselves? Does it some way change how they ought to be treated?
No, I don't think it changes. It's just, this is the new day and age. This is it. You know, I mean, ask Warren Buffett, how much money did he make in the 60s and 70s? And how much money has he made in 2024? I mean, this is called growth. Look, I played for free on the Olympic team. I played for free when we won two back-to-back championships, national championships at Old Dominion University. It's okay. You know, we have to celebrate today the athletes, the business people, the women, people of success, even men, and we shouldn't tolerate them. We should applaud them and celebrate them that they have more than we did. And you should just organically be happy for them. And I'm thrilled for this generation and what they're doing. They're creating history. You know, we have the Jackie Robinsons and, you know, a lot of people have played sports and some people just change sports and make history.
Well, and you know, the history is happening. I don't want to cut you off. I'm sorry, Nancy. Finish your point.
No, it's happening right here in front of us. Yeah.
I was going to say on that very notion, just thinking about the ratings, I mean, how many people are watching? This is transformative as well. I learned that the game between LSU and Iowa last night, more than 12 million people watched the game. That's even more than last year's NBA finals, by the way. And these college players, they're thrown into this level of fame right now. Is the sport ready for this level of attention? Is it ready for this evolution of the fan viewership too?
Are we ever ready? Are we ever ready for greatness? No, it just happens upon us. The Caitlin Clarks of the world, the Paige Beckers, the Reeses, there's a lot of players who are generational. They're in the WNBA, you know, Asia Wilson, people like that who are champions. You know, I admire Dawn Staley. And, you know, I also admire people who respect women. And the way you change the landscape is you do what Ice Cube did. You make a substantial offer to a woman and you say, we appreciate you, we want you. And, you know, that's not to say that she can't play in the WNBA. I'm W and NBA family. But it certainly pushes you to be better and raise the stakes. Players really have a lot of the they have a lot of the power right now, right? Know the power you don't know you have. And they know they have it right now. And why shouldn't they? This is business, just like everybody else. Everybody has a negotiating point. You know, so I think it's great for Caitlin to get that offer.
And will she take it? Would she take it? Because there's been some pushback on that offer. It's a substantial one. There was some pushback. I talked to Carrie Champion last week, and she seemed to have the impression of, look, this is, she doesn't need to play with men to prove her worth. Is that how you see it?
Well, as somebody who needed to play against men to know her worth, and I love Carrie, by the way, but I didn't have a league in my prime. So I had to play for Pat Riley and the Los Angeles Lakers in summer league. I had to play for the Jazz and Frank Layton in their summer league. I had to play 2 years in the United States Basketball League, which is the equivalent of the NBA G League. Trust me, I know what it's like to get hit on a screen by a 280-pound guy or pick up a charge on Karl Malone. It doesn't feel good. It's not optimal, but it is doable. Because think about it. They might be bigger, stronger, faster, jump higher, but you don't know our heart. You don't know our desire. There's EQ and IQ, and she can pass the hell out of the basketball. So wherever she chooses to play, and if she went to the big three, then she could also play in the WNBA, you know, if it's for Indiana. You know, Cuba's saying, we want you to play both. It's eight games in the W, but it would enhance her profile. She'd be the only other woman to play in a men's league. Wow. And that changed my life, to be quite honest. Financially, it changed my life. It took me from being a great player in women's basketball to being elite in you know, the opportunity that I've had to play against men. No.
Well, listen, Caitlin Clark, it sounds like Nancy Lieberman wants to be your coach for the big three. I'm just going to put a plug in. I kind of want to see it now. I'm just talking to you. Nancy, it's always so great to hear your perspective. It's a unique one, and I'm so glad you came. Thank you.
Thank you for being a great champion of us. Appreciate you.
Thank you all so much for watching. Our coverage continues.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.